Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it. On this week's programme, I'm bringing you the second part of my interview with Dr. Antonia McManus, whose book, Irish Education, The Ministerial Legacy 1919-1999, was published recently by the History Press Ireland. On last week's programme, we heard how the effort to revive spoken Irish in the country dominated Irish education policy for the first four decades of the new state's existence. We also heard how four ministers rather than one were responsible for the policy to provide free second level education for all students. And finally, we heard how timing and resources can influence a minister's success in the education portfolio. This week, I continue my conversation with Antonia McManus. I first revisited a matter that was discussed on last week's programme. It was about Donna O'Malley's announcement of free second level education for all. I noted that when he made the announcement of free second level education, he had no approval in advance from the Department of Finance. I asked Antonia if that move was strategic and if in doing so he had the support of the Taoiseach of the day, Sean Lamass.
I would say it was strategic and it certainly had the support of Lamass. I mean, Jack Lynch was the Minister for Finance and he was out of the country. You know, very good time to make an announcement like that. But Sean Lamass, he was nearing the very end of his political career and he wanted to cherish all the children of the nation equally, give them equal opportunities. Education meant a lot to Sean Lamass. He was an early school leaver himself. He prioritised education, but he was also in tune with what parents wanted. They were naturally very enthusiastic for free second level education for their children because it would open up opportunities, and it did. It certainly did. Because fast forward to the 90s, we were topping Europe for the most educated workforce, second after Germany for the skills of our workers. But coming back to what you asked me there, Sean, was it strategic? And it was a plan that that Lamass had. There's a precedent for it. He advised Collie on similar lines. He took his young ministers under his wing and told them what to do, literally, to get what you want and how to circumvent the Department of Finance. I don't know, did Don O'Malley go beyond his brief in the announcement? Who knows? But it was amusing because he said he was very happy to be making his maiden speech in front of a group of journalists when he was making the announcement on Dunleary. Yeah, his maiden speech, the journalists were his personal friends. But having said all of that, what he did was, it was groundbreaking. But there were others who were maybe they could have been treated a little more sensitively. I mean, the secondary school authorities had laboured long and hard in the vineyard and they didn't get an awful lot of credit for it. They actually had only a miserable capitation grant and they provided secondary education, Sean, for children, from over all those years. And from 1924 to 25, there were 278 secondary schools in Ireland. That increased in 1950-51 to over 424. Now, the fees they charged were very modest and they remitted them entirely on occasions. They managed to cater for a doubling of enrolments in secondary schools on just two occasions, 1945 and 1963. But in 1963, there were more 16-year-olds getting secondary education in Ireland than there were in the UK, even though they had free education from 1944. Now, in 1964, they did get a building grant. And at that stage, they had crippling debts, which I think is perfectly understandable. But they should be given the credit for that.
Because, and this would largely have been the religious
institutions. Oh, absolutely.
Institutions,
yeah. Largely the religious institutions.
Yeah.
And the state just steered clear, really. These were private schools that were giving the education. They gave, as I say, a capitation grant. Now, from 64, they got their building grant and an increase in the capitation grant. It just happened to be coming up to a general election and there were other reasons involved. They were trying to introduce comprehensive education at the time, so there were political reasons as well for being generous.
Was free secondary education introduced gradually, year by year, or was it a sudden revolution to the system?
It was a sudden revolution to the system.
So how did it cope?
It was a great achievement. It's particularly the transport It was a wonderful education. My mother actually taught in the secondary school system at the time. And I mean, they really were shell-shocked because they had wall-to-wall students in their schools. And she was one of the most dedicated teachers I knew. But I knew she found this challenging at the time, naturally. Because Donal O'Malley said there mustn't be any grading. Students were entitled to do their Leaving Cert if they wanted to do their Leaving Cert. And teachers knew that not all students are ready for it, or maybe a different curriculum would suit them. And there lay another problem. The curriculum hadn't caught up with the poor students that were coming, getting their free second level education. But wonderful work has been done in the area of curriculum development to make it suitable for children that are not enamoured of the academic curriculum. Because it's a cruel thing to do to have children in a system where the curriculum doesn't suit their needs. But that has advanced considerably.
And where did they get all the teachers that they would have needed all of a sudden?
That's why I say wall-to-wall students. I think my mother went from a very tiny pupil-teacher ratio to something quite extensive. That didn't stop her working very hard for them. And, you know, she was very, very happy that there was free second-level education. It had its teething problems, all right.
Looking back over the ministers for education, some of them were former teachers. I'm thinking of Mary O'Rourke or Micheál Martin, and some weren't. Did that make a difference in terms of their legacy?
Now, the curious thing is that those who made the greatest contributions were a doctor from Clare, an engineer from Limerick, and a barrister from Dublin, because that was Patrick Hillary's, the doctor. You had George Colley, who's the solicitor, and you have the engineers, Donal O'Malley. Teachers, I would say, Niamh Rana was a teacher as well. Mary O'Rourke, yes, they were very much in tune. You had Niamh Rana, Mary O'Rourke. Pádraig Faulkner was a teacher, national school teacher. Dick Burke was a secondary school teacher.
Was Gemma Hussey?
Gemma Hussey had a language school, I think. But yeah, she would have been very, very familiar with educational matters and was a very, I think, a pioneering minister for education myself, I have to say. Now, she did what hadn't the most cordial relationship with the teaching unions, but as we say, Sinsgeilele, that's another story. But certainly she was very progressive and had great ideas and introduced very significant reforms into the Department of Education. She was the first person, really, who had an overall plan for education. Like, we weren't very good on our white papers. There weren't any up to 1980. But she really had an overall plan with her Programme for Action in Education in 1984. And she consulted widely on it. Now, that was unheard of. And people are a bit taken aback and a little suspicious of her at the time. She set up the Interim Curriculum and Examinations Board, and she consulted all the partners in education, as they were called then. It was a partnership approach from her period in office. And she also took parents into the policy planning process, which was a wonderful thing to do.
Were the National Parents' Councils, were they set up in her tenure?
She set it up in 1985. She provided funding for the establishment of the National Parents' Council. And she designated a range of issues on which they should be formally consulted by the department. So this was very, very respectful of them, and it really set them on the road to becoming, to getting recognition. Now, which was a long road, because they had been ignored for four decades, completely excluded from the education system for four decades. I mean, ministers paid lip service to it, like Éamon de Valera. He said, they may not be experts in education, but their judgment is often far wiser than those who set themselves up as educational experts.
This is Éamon de Valera, isn't
it? Yes, indeed. And then the man who followed after him, Sean Moylan and Richard Mulcahy and Thomas Derrick, they could see no place for them. There was no need for them. Thomas Derrick was told the parents were awfully upset over the Irish language policy. And he was asked to set up an inquiry. He says, I am the Minister for Education. I, as Minister for Education, I am in possession of greater knowledge and greater experience of this matter. He was only 3 years in his ministry at the time.
And looking back now, and I mean, I think we get a sense of, if I go through a few of them in particular, I mean, I suppose in recent memory, Micheál Martin, what would you say? I mean, he was the one who steered through the Education Act.
He did.
Even though it had been through five different ministers.
Altogether, I mean, five, that's right.
Was that unusual that it was so slow for that to come together?
Not really. No, not really. Micheál Martin, he was only 37 years old. We forget that. He's a mature man now, but he was only 37 when we got this through, which was some achievement. The groundwork now, admittedly, had been done by Niamh Rana. A great deal of the groundwork had been completed by her. And the white paper had been, which was a huge success, her white paper, because she'd held a national education convention to discuss the green paper. And there were 42 different organisations invited to it. So it was a great democratic event altogether. But Micheál Martin, yes, he took it safely through, effortlessly, but he made his own changes to it. And he, the five ministers had different plans for, well, start off with Mary O'Rourke, for instance. She wanted to introduce county committees of education. The churches bided their time. They weren't very enamoured of having these bodies set up. So she was replaced by Seamus Brennan, and he introduced the executive agencies, which would have been fewer in number, not quite so powerful. He was replaced by Niamh Rannoch, and she wanted to introduce regional education councils. Then she's replaced in 1997 by Micheál Martin, and he reverts to the executive agencies. And that puts paid to the local education committee idea. Now, from 1990 right up to 1999, efforts had been made to introduce those, what we call local education councils. They were called different names by different ministers. In the first, up to the 1950s, it was the INTO that wanted them. That was for school maintenance purposes. But then from 1975 up to 1999, it was the ministers from Dick Burke, Gemma Hussey, up to those I've just mentioned now, Sean. They all want it, with the exception of Seamus Brennan and Micheál Martin.
And they're not there now?
They are there now. Oh, yeah, we got them. So the executive agencies, I suppose you call the State's Examination Commission, these agencies, NCCA.
Okay, so this is farming out some of the work from the department to these independent bodies.
That's exactly
bodies.
It, okay. Yes, because they had the inspectors had an excessive workload. There's no question about that.
So you're talking about the National Education Welfare Board, examinations, NCCA, okay.
Those bodies, but they also got help from support groups like the PCSP or the second level support group, you know, where teachers are seconded and the help out.
But they're not regional in the sense of...
No, not at all. No.
And the education centres, that was Niamh Rannoch who...
No, it wasn't. It wasn't Niamh Rannoch. The education centres actually date back to 1972 to Pádraig Faulkner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had great ideas too, but there again, he didn't have a bountiful measure of finance to aid him. Yeah, he had very interesting plans for in-service education actually, but the budget was cut from 77,000 down to 12,000 between 74 and 75, and teachers were very annoyed over that. Understandably so, because it's just so important. The European Social Fund, it came to our assistance for in-service education during Niamh Rannoch's time in particular.
Right.
But there was that funding available from Europe, which was great, from the 70s.
And if we go then to another minister who we still hear a little bit from, Mary O'Rourke, what would you say is her legacy?
Mary's legacy to education was quite significant, actually. She set up the Primary Education Review Body and the Review of Primary Education, two bodies. And that had been outstanding for 20 years. John Wilson didn't set one up, but she did. So the new curriculum, as we call it, the child-centred curriculum of 71, that hadn't been reviewed. But she did that and did it very thoroughly. And as a result of that, that led on to the revised programme, the primary programme, in 1999. That was extremely important. She did a lot for educationally disadvantaged.
Gemma Hussey had been the first minister to set aside a budget to support disadvantaged students.
Mary O'Rourke set up the schemes of assistance for schools in designated areas of disadvantage. Also, the homeschool community liaison scheme. She got a trebling of funding for disadvantage. That was extremely important and was widely acclaimed by the OECD. Special education, she set up the Special Education Review Committee, which in 1993 came up with that wonderful report which signposted the way for the development of special education. Now, there wasn't one little area where she, in special education, she did say that she signed up to the EU, the EU commitment to integrate children with special educational needs into the mainstream system. But she said she had reservations about in certain circumstances. And it actually took a High Court action in 1993. That High Court action placed an onus on ministers to provide appropriate education for all children, whatever their disabilities, as of right. And that was done in the Education Act.
Yeah. And to what extent is the minister's legacy tied in with the legacy of the Secretary General of the department?
Oh, absolutely. I don't mention the officials per se, but I suppose that the final decision rests with the minister, but of course. I mean, Sean O'Connor was the secretary in the department and he pushed reform.
What were his dates?
His dates, Sean, he was, when I can tell you the ministers, Dick Burke would have been come greatly under his influence. George Colley, Jack Lynch, slightly. Jack Lynch, George Colley, Dick Burke. Yeah, I think I've mentioned all the around the late 60s, 70s era, yeah. But he had wonderful ideas, which he promoted. Now, he was not the most diplomatic of men, it has to be said, because he wrote to studies in 1968 about post-primary education here and in the future, and it was very controversial. Diplomacy wasn't his strong point, but he was a very dedicated, very, very dedicated official who did progress Irish education policy without question, because he put it before the ministers. What should be done, and some listened, some didn't.
To what extent do you think ministers have been successful in translating policy into the classroom? You know, I mean, it's one thing to set up a body or to do some, but to actually influence practice in the classroom, which minister do you think was most successful there?
That's a really good question, Sean. I would give the prize to Niamh Ranagh, I have to say. I would, because she tackled educational disadvantage at every level, really. The Early Start programme, preschool programme, breaking the cycle, that's at first level. At second level, there was the JCSP, the Junior Certificate School programme, the Leaving Certificate Vocational programme, the Leaving Certificate Applied. Also, at third level, she actually gave funding for disadvantaged, the disadvantaged fund at third level, because she was very committed to the disadvantaged children. At third level, in 1993, the Provost of Trinity College made a very interesting statement. He drew people's attention to the fact that students from unskilled and semi-skilled socioeconomic backgrounds, very few of them were attending Trinity, only 1.3%. He warns that if that level of educational inequality persisted, that it would entrench social inequality and divisions and lead to a virtual caste system. Well, now, any minister would have to sit up and take notice of that one, as Dr. Thomas Mitchell. She did take up the gauntlet, though, and did give funding for access programmes into third level. And they continue, of course, to this day. Various access measures are in place.
If you were advisor to a minister for education who wanted to leave a legacy, what kind of advice would you give the minister?
Take care of the weakest in the system. Don't neglect the weakest in the system. That's probably the part of, when I was doing the research, the one thing that really got me was the attention wasn't paid to children. In 1931, attending school, where 43% of children attending primary schools in Clonmel were malnourished. 10% of children attending schools in Newbridge, in Kildare, were malnourished. 6% of children attending schools down in Cork were malnourished. That they were far removed from the harsh realities of Irish life. So I would say nurture the weakest in the system, and you'd be doing yourself proud and the country proud. Ambitions to leave a legacy. Oh, gosh, I'm probably the worst person on this earth to give that kind of advice, because I see it from the historian. I like recording historical facts. An advisor? No, don't come to me looking for that.
And which minister do you think achieved the most?
Which minister achieved the most? Few of them, really. Definitely Dr. Patrick Hillary. Definitely Donna O'Malley. Then it's all unfair to those that could have achieved the most because they had the ideas, like Dick Burke could have achieved so much. John Boland could have achieved so much.
They didn't have the money or the time.
John Boland ran out of time too, but yeah. He definitely ran out. He only had a year. They didn't have the money. In truth, Niamh Ranagh made a very significant, particularly with the Universities Act of 1997 was a stunning achievement. And the reason I say that, Sean, is because she came up against, naturally, a knot of opposition from the most articulate and the smartest people in the country. I'm sure they're lovely people, but they knew how to fight their corner. And when she produced her Universities Bill in 1996, she was opposed, there were objections from Garrett Fitzgerald. He was very, very angry with her because he said she was giving too much power to the HEA and not enough to the universities, not respecting their autonomy. And he said that it was an extraordinary authoritarian bill. Even Thatcherite, he described it. And I mean, very high-profile people were very, very vocal against it. And UCG, RUCC and UCD, they objected to it because, obviously, change is difficult for people. But the Senate of the NUI, the IFUT, Irish Federation of University Teachers, they all objected to it in various stages. But she got it through in the end. She had to make 100 amendments to it. But for the first time, there was outside representation on the board of Trinity College since its foundation in 1592. What an achievement. And it was general agreement that she did come up with a balanced act in the end, a balanced act in the end. But it was a thorny path she had to travel to get there. But she had the courage to do it.
And this might be the same answer, but which minister do you admire most?
I greatly admire Patrick Hillary and George Colley and Donna O'Malley. I think they're very committed. I would have great admiration also for Gemma Hussey and Mary O'Rourke of Rana, not because they're females, Sean, I hasten to add, but they were very, very solid ministers for education. Micheál Martin, it has to be said, did make a good, valuable contribution as well. In the area of higher education research, the area of special needs assistance, they all made a they were all genuine people that tried to do their best. Some did it better than others. But I would have massive respect for anybody in politics because the hoops they have to go through and the machinations, I certainly wouldn't... I'm not at all equipped to deal with that, I have to say. But there's extraordinary credit due to them and the progress they made, particularly in the latter years.
So that's what it seems to me, that there seems to be a split, that the, you know, there's, say from, say, the time of Jack Lynch, which was kind of, he was minister from 57. It's almost like as if you divide pre-57 and that those ministers... legacy was more unfortunate or less rich than the ones that came afterwards. Would that be right?
I would say it would be very wrong of me not to acknowledge the contribution of the early ministers for education, Sean, because what they were, I mean, imagine conducting your ministry during a civil war and that dutiful man still turned up to work every day. It was quite extraordinary. They were very, I would say about the early ministers, yes, they were authoritarian, yes, they were completely committed to the Gaelicisation policy, but they were all very genuine and they were hard working. They really were, particularly the first man there, J.G. O'Kelly. He had several jobs going. He was on the run during his ministry for much of that time. But I would be loath to say one was superior to another, just some possibly achieved, or obviously achieved more than another. Maybe others, if they had the finances, that they could have achieved it as well. What if? Who knows?
Antonia, how does education as a ministry compare in prospective ministers' eyes to other ministries?
Well, Sean, up to the ministry of Pádraig Faulkner, there wasn't very much funding for the Ministry of Education. And as you know, status and funding practically go hand in hand. Now, Pádraig Faulkner said that he was delighted to get promotion to a department that where there was great progress and where that was treated with a bit of dignity. So from there on in, it became a coveted department. Well, I suppose really, though, from Sean Lamass, when he prioritised education, when funding started at that stage, it came through 65, 66, 67. Okay, there were a few years in the 70s where the funding wasn't as great. But Pádraig Faulkner certainly felt that he was in a department that was vibrant, or could be, and he could do things, and he was enthusiastic for it. Because I suppose they were all young ministers. The one thing they had in common, they were ambitious, they were going places. The Department of Education, they viewed that as a department that was rising, and yes, but here up to that, it would have been deemed to be not the more important of the ministries.
Writing of the book, how long did it actually take you? I mean, you were gathering the material,
indeed,
obviously, for a long time,
yeah,
but writing it, how long did it take?
It was a 5-year project. Yeah, I actually relinquished my position at Hibernia College to concentrate. I knew, obviously, I couldn't be the director of a programme, a busy programme like that, and carry out the research properly. So I decided, yeah, this was the path I'll take, and I've no regrets about it. So I'm currently researching another book on T.G. O'Connell, the long-standing General Secretary of the INTO. I found him fascinating, Sean. When I was doing the research on this book, I found him equally interesting because he was quite tenacious. He was the opposition spokesman from 22 to 32 in the Dáil, and he really kept the ministers on their toes. He asked the difficult questions, but sadly he didn't get the responses were very disappointing for him.
But he was opposition spokesperson and General Secretary of the INTO at the same time.
And a Labour TD. That's correct. Yeah, that is correct. Most unusual. Yeah, he was General Secretary and leader of the Labour Party from 1927 to 32, although he found he was very relieved when he lost a seat in the 1932 election. But he was an extraordinary man. He wrote the history, the 100 years of the history of the INTO. He was a founding member of the Irish Red Cross and of the Education and Building Society. But to write that history, I mean, I have gone through it, and it is exhaustive. It was a wonderful achievement. He wrote it, he was in his 80s, very shortly before his death. It was published in 1969, and he died thereafter.
And it sounds like Antonia is well on the way to writing another interesting book on Irish education. Well, that's where we bring this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest, Antonia McManus, for her time. And I have to say, I'm really happy to recommend her book, Irish Education, The Ministerial Legacy, 1919 to 1999, for anyone who wants to understand education policy and the recent history of Irish education. If you'd like to suggest a guest for a future programme, or if you would like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to me by email. The address is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to 215 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. But until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.